Clerk will please announce counsel. All right, Ms. McFatridge.
May it please the court. In this plea to the jurisdiction case, the city asks the court to reverse the partial denial of the city's plea and dismiss Ms. Lane's case. The Supreme Court has held that the elements of a whistleblower claim are jurisdictional. If the city established in the trial court that Ms. Lane failed to plead a violation of the Whistleblower Act, and we think we did, the trial court lacked jurisdiction over her claim. The city is immune from suit under the Whistleblower Act unless the pleadings allege a violation of the act. To establish a violation of the act, Ms. Lane must allege that she made a good faith report of a violation of law. As a result, the question before the court is whether the undisputed jurisdictional facts establish a violation of the Whistleblower Act. The jurisdictional facts material to this appeal can be summed up in one sentence. In 2008, Ms. Lane reported that the former city auditor violated Chapter 252 of the Local Government Code, which governs certain purchases by municipalities, with respect to a request for proposals issued in 2007 for auditing services. These undisputed jurisdictional facts compel dismissal because Ms. Lane's report...
These were the accounting services that an accountant had to perform?
These were auditing services, so not necessarily performed by an accountant. They are held to the same professional standards as an accountant, but they were described in the RFP and the contract as auditing services, that is, reviewing claims, health care claims made under the city's health care plan.
And can you explain what is the distinction between the two causes of action upon which the trial court did grant the plea to the jurisdiction as opposed to what's remaining?
Yes. The underlying causes of action was one whistleblower claim based on two allegations. One, that the city auditor's conduct violated the Public Information Act and that it violated Chapter 252, the competitive procurement law. Under the Public Information Act, the trial court granted the plea there because the disclosure that she alleged was made to another city official. And under the Public Information Act, making a disclosure to another city official is not a disclosure under the Act. For Ms. Lane's report to have been made in good faith, she must prove two things. First, she must have actually believed that the city auditor violated Chapter 252, and second, her belief must have been reasonable based on her training and experience. For the purpose of this appeal, the city does not dispute the first prong of the good faith element, her subjective belief. The issue for the court is the second element, whether her belief was objectively reasonable. That is, the court must determine whether a similarly situated employee would have believed that the city auditor violated Chapter 252. Ms. Lane is a licensed Texas attorney. The question, then, is whether a licensed Texas attorney would reasonably believe that Chapter 252 applied to an RFP for auditing services. 7 years before Ms. Lane made her report, this court held, in the City of Denton case, that auditing services are professional services. Chapter 252 expressly does not apply to professional services contracts. The Act states this chapter does not apply to an expenditure for professional services. In light of this plain, straightforward language, would a reasonable attorney have believed that Chapter 252 applied to a request for proposals for auditing services? No.
But doesn't it take it out of that exception when the city itself voluntarily opts to follow the statutory procurement provisions?
It does not. The city is allowed under the law to use any process it chooses for professional services, and using a request for proposals process enables the city to get more information from those who are able to provide the service. The Attorney General said in the opinion cited in our brief that the city can use that process. But by using that process, it does not make that law apply to the city.
But it seems once you've elected to use that process, then the rules related to that process should apply. In other words, the city exercised its discretion and choice by deciding to opt into that process?
Well, it's similar to the facts in the Title VII case that we cited in the brief, the Cross case, where in that case the employer adopted a standard that was greater than what Title VII required. And the court said in that case an employer is free to adopt whatever internal standards it prefers, but it doesn't, by doing that, impose Title VII liability on itself when there's some violation of its internal policy.
If some other person who was bidding on this job had asked to see other people's bids, would they have been allowed to see them?
No.
Why not?
Because of the process that the purchasing department used, they just would not have done it as a matter of practice.
Well, why not?
That is just their internal practice, and I can't go beyond about why not. That's what they told me, is that we just don't do it that way. Now, I guess what you're really getting at is, if the law didn't protect it, then why couldn't we have? I would argue that we still could have. It's just that according to their internal practice, they wouldn't have done it.
Wouldn't have allowed anybody else to see other people's bids.
That is their practice. They would not have done it. Ms. Lane would have the court believe that the city is required to follow Chapter 252 because of the city's internal purchasing policy. It tracks state law. She argues that her belief was objectively reasonable because of the city's purchasing policy. But she's incorrect. The city's policy has the same exception for professional services state law does. It says, state law allows the purchase of some goods and services without using the competitive bid process, including a procurement for professional services. A reasonably prudent attorney would have read the city's policy and concluded that it did not make Chapter 252 apply to this RFP. The undisputed jurisdictional facts in this case do not establish a violation of the Whistleblower Act. Instead, they show that Ms. Lane's belief that the law had been violated was not objectively reasonable. Consequently, her report was not made in good faith. The trial court did not have jurisdiction over her claim, and the city's plea should have been granted. Therefore, the court should reverse the trial court's partial denial of the city's plea and dismiss Ms. Lane's case. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Ms. McFatrin. Mr. Cobes.
Thank you, Your Honor. May I please the court. Janet Lane was an employee of the City of Fort Worth for over 18 years. She was a senior staff auditor in the Internal Audit Department. She was terminated by the city, and we've alleged that that termination was a result of this report that she made to the city hotline and to the FBI. The elements of the whistleblower case that we have pled are that she was a public employee, that she made a good faith report of a violation of law to an appropriate law enforcement agency, and that as a result of that, she was terminated. The first, third, and fourth of those elements are not disputed for purposes of this interlocutory appeal by the city. The second element, though, is the good faith report of a violation of law. That's really a combination of two concepts, a good faith report and a violation of law. The city goes to great lengths to show that there was an alternative to the request for proposal process, the competitive bidding process, that could have been employed by the city that would not have been a violation of law. And they take the position that if they can show that what they could have done was legal, then Lane could not have formed a good faith objective belief that the law had been violated because she was a lawyer. And I think there's kind of the implicit concept that if you're a lawyer, you must know exactly what the law is at all times. And because she was a lawyer, a non-practicing lawyer, though, that she must have known that there was another way for the city to have obtained this contract without following the strict competitive procurement law that they followed. Justice Livingston, you've raised a good point. Once the city elected to go down that road, do they have to continue to go down the road? Justice Dofano raised an important issue, I think. Would somebody else have been able to see these documents, these pre-bid documents, out of order, out of turn? I think that question is answered, or at least we tried to address that question in our response to the plea to the jurisdiction in this way. The city manager has delegated to the city purchasing department the decision-making issue on whether to follow competitive procurement laws or not. And we've cited and attached our response to the plea to the jurisdiction the actual sections that show that delegation. And we put in testimony from Kevin Carl, a senior buyer, as to how that process works. And it was the city purchasing department that employed, that made the decision to employ the competitive bid process. And at least from their perspective, they attempted to comply with the competitive bid process all the way through. And he was the person that was in charge of it, and he described how the process worked. But the important distinction, at least what we tried to establish in the response to the plea to the jurisdiction, was it was not the audit department, it was not Janet Lane's decision or power, even the city auditor to whom she reported. They didn't have the power. They had not been delegated the authority to determine whether the competitive bid process would be followed or not followed. That delegation was clear, and it was from the city manager to the purchasing department. Once the purchasing department made that decision, we believe that it is a violation of the competitive procurement laws, once invoked by the purchasing department, to disclose the kind of information that Janet Lane reported. And so we think that not only was there a violation of law at issue, but that her subjective belief and an objectively reasonable belief from a third-person standpoint existed. And we think that we've proved that. And certainly at this stage of the proceeding, we're not here after a summary judgment where both sides have put on evidence. We're here very early on at the plea to the jurisdiction stage to determine where the court can even consider this case. And I'd point out a couple of things on that, and then I'll take any questions and I'll be done. The purpose of the whistleblower statute is twofold. One is to protect public employees like Janet Lane, to give them some assurance that they can make reports and not be retaliated against. The second, of course, is to secure lawful conduct from our governmental agencies. The cases tell us, and we've cited a couple, that because the whistleblower statute is remedial in nature, it's to be liberally construed. And we cited City of Houston and the Castaneda case. Liberal construction of the whistleblower statute, to me, means that a claim like this, where she's alleged every element of the act, put on evidence to support those allegations at this very early stage, that jurisdiction then exists in the trial court for further discovery. And if summary judgments are filed, then certainly we can look at those and look at that issue. But at this very early stage, to say that it's impossible for Janet Lane to have formed an objectionably reasonable belief that the law was violated hasn't been established in the trial court. The trial court said, Judge Birdwell said, that standard had not been met, and so he denied the plea on that basis. So unless there's questions, I'll sit down. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Cubs. Ms. McPatrick.
The city does not disagree with what Mr. Coves described as the purpose of the Whistleblower Act, but I think it's important to note that when the Supreme Court defined good faith in Wichita County versus Hart, it said that there are two competing interests here. The Whistleblower Act protects public employees who attempt to report illegal activity. At the same time, public employers must preserve their right to discipline employees who make either intentionally false or objectively unreasonable reports. That's what we have here, an objectively unreasonable report. With respect to the question, could someone else have reviewed the documents? That issue almost goes to the merits. If someone else had reviewed the documents, if Joe Blow off the street had reviewed them, and that's what she had reported, we'd still be here today. Because the question is whether any of those activities violated Chapter 252, because she reported that that conduct violated Chapter 252. Well, the process isn't covered by Chapter 252, so it doesn't matter who it was revealed to. In this case, it wasn't revealed to Joe Blow, but I think it's important to note.
Was the purpose of the request to allow Joe Blow, who happened to be a friend of Garland Asher, to find out what the bids were, what the competition was?
That also goes to the merits, Your Honor. We dispute that. We're not going to raise that as a fact issue here because it's not a jurisdictional fact. But Mr. Triantafylides will deny that that's what the conversation was. So for the purpose of the appeal, we'll agree that that was the reason for the disclosure. But even if it were true, it wouldn't violate Chapter 252.
But doesn't the, it looks like in Addendum 4, we've got the actual request for proposals.
Yes.
Doesn't that in and of itself indicate that it's going to follow the procedure and this is what is provided to, I guess, anyone?
It's the procedure that the city chose to follow. It does point out that it's professional in that it requires the professional liability insurance. But as Mr. Cobes pointed out, the process the city decided to use, that the purchasing department decided to use, was by virtue of the administrative regulation that's in evidence. And the administrative regulation itself says that professional services are not required to be competitively bid.
But they were.
We used the process, but an entity that voluntarily adopts a process that's espoused under state law doesn't bring itself within the state law, just as in the Cross case under Title VII. If we go down the road that if we follow a law that doesn't apply to us, so now that we're under that law, it's going to discourage us from using a process that would be helpful to us because we might have other liability that we hadn't had in the past, or we'd incur liability we wouldn't necessarily have. That doesn't serve the taxpayers or the city when it prohibits us from getting more information for us to make a better decision. Ms. Lane alleges that she reported that the former city auditor, her supervisor, did three things. He asked her for a draft of the RFP. He told her that another city official wanted to review the draft on behalf of a friend who wanted to bid on the project. And he told her that another city official wanted to look at one of the responsive bids. I'll direct your attention to the affidavit that she filed in the trial court, which is in the record, where she admits that the friend never did bid. You'll also note that the purpose of Mr. Asher reviewing it was because the city council had put him on a committee whose job it was to provide advice and direction for auditing and financial activities. It was his job to look at this request for proposals. Did it include all the requests that they needed? Did it achieve the purpose of the audit? It was his job to look at the responsive bids. Was the bidder that they were thinking of hiring going to provide the services that this committee decided they needed? No reasonably prudent attorney would have believed that Chapter 252 made it illegal for the city auditor to review a request for proposals for auditing services drafted by a member of his own staff.
No, it was the bids that he wanted to look at, right?
She alleges two things. The request for proposals itself before it was out, a draft of that, and then once it was out, to look at one of the bids. And if you read the record carefully, what happened, if you look at her affidavit, you'll see that after they got the responsive bids, then her boss said, okay, which one are you thinking we're going to hire? And she said, well, I don't think we can afford number one, probably number two. And he said, okay, take number two and give it to me so I can let Mr. Asher look at it.
What was this about having a friend who wanted to bid?
That's what she alleged. And then in the affidavit, she says they discovered that he couldn't bid on it. There's a paragraph where she talks about after they discovered he could not bid, Mr. Asher and Mr. Triantafylides had a three-hour lunch. So she admits that he never did bid on it.
And tell me again her job title and what department she was in.
She was in the internal audit office, and she had several different job titles. She was a fraud investigator. She was a senior auditor, I believe. So she was a management-level employee.
So she really wasn't hired by the city and was not in the legal department?
No, she is not an attorney for the city. She had a law license, but she was an internal auditor.
But your position is that we still attribute to her the benefits, if you will, of a law license, even though she's not acting in that capacity?
She's not acting in that. The answer to the question is yes, you should, because the cases say look at her training and experience. Her training is as a lawyer, but she is practicing law. She's appeared in Tarrant County on behalf of four clients. Just because she's not in the city attorney's office doesn't mean she's not actively practicing law. The jurisdictional facts establish that Ms. Lane did not have a good faith belief that the city auditor's conduct violated Chapter 252 of the Local Government Code. As a result, she cannot establish that she made a good faith report of a violation of law. She has not alleged a violation of the Whistleblower Act, and the city's immunity from suit has not been waived. This case should be dismissed. Thank you.
All right, counsel, we appreciate your briefing and your arguments today. Your case is submitted.